It's a great honour to speak on behalf of the largest single party in this place. And may I say that if I needed any convincing at all, that the best thing for Britain is to leave here as soon as possible. It was the way that those elections were conducted yesterday. Wow, yeah, because if that is this place's idea of democracy, then that is a serious betrayal of every country that is represented here. Yeah. Because it is not democratic at all. And that is just one of many reasons why Britain is right to be leaving this place, hopefully, on Halloween. And it is right because there is a pattern consistent throughout history of oppressed people turning on the oppressors, slaves against their owners, the peasantry against the feudal barons, colonies, Mr. Verhofstadt, against their empires. And that is why Britain is leaving. And it doesn't matter which language you use, we are going and we are glad to be going. I represent the southwest of the United Kingdom.
Piano, facciamo concludere.
And I found on my Grazie. Very first day that this place has decided, at least this place hasn't, the powers that be have decided to actually increase the size of fishermen's meshes, thereby reducing their income by 40%. That's what you do here. That's why we're going.
Grazie, news concluda.
Are long, wir gehen, we're off.
Grazie.
Lovely to have you, Anne Widdecombe.
Lovely to be with you.
The world according to Widdy. I think that's got a lovely ring to it, Anne Widdecombe. I really do. I think in a different life you could have taken over the world, my love. You know that?
Well, not at the moment, I think. Not at the moment.
Not at the moment. Actually, in fairness, let's talk about the world situation before we get on to John Bercow. Many of my callers this evening, and I'm quite sure you'll have an opinion on this, are deeply uncomfortable. Obviously, no one wants this to escalate. No one wants the situation in Ukraine to escalate. Most people understand the reasons why we can't implement an open fly zone, why we can't have things escalate in Russia. But Ben Habib, myself, many people have been making this point that we sort of allowed Ukraine to flirt with the West. We allowed Ukraine to, we sort of intervened in Ukraine when it came to the revolution of about 8 or so years ago. We have had Ukraine cooperating a lot with NATO, though not as a full member. We've encouraged them to become a part of the EU. And many people have made the point that we are somewhat now, when they need us, we're saying, well, we don't really want to get involved because Russia might retaliate. So here are some weapons. You kind of do it for us. What's your opinion on that?
I don't think we're being particularly weak about it. I mean, we are giving them an awful lot of weaponry. And I would like to see us give much more, but we're giving an awful lot. Now, it is a fact of life that if we impose a no-fly zone and it is violated and we shoot down a Russian plane, we're at war with Russia. Now, you know, no sane person wants that as an outcome. So I think it would be very much better that we continue to arm and supply Ukraine and sanction Russia. And already the Russians are not having it all their own way. They thought they were just going to float into Ukraine and sort of take over in no time at all. They can't even manage an invasion, let alone an occupation.
These days, and it's why we have now such a low quality parliament on both sides of the House. I mean, it's really low. And it is because for about 25 years now, the major parties, at any rate, have selected by identity rather than merit. And I've actually seen this up close, firsthand. So they give priority to women, to people of ethnic origin, to gays, to whatever it might be. They're interested in quotas. Now, in our day, it was merit. And, you know, the women had to take on the men and they had to beat the men. There was no question of, well, you get special treatment. The result was, you know, you had your Thatchers, and on the other side of the house, you had your Shirley Williams, you had your Barbara Castles. You had people of real substance. And, you know, I think of the big chancellors of those times, you know, people like Nigel Lawson. I mean, you look around now, and there's nobody of that quality in the House of Commons, because they've come through a completely different route. And I think the worst manifestation is, and the Tories have an A-list, so I mean, you know, I criticise them as well. But the worst manifestation is the Labour Party's all-women shortlist. So if you're a man who's lived in a particular constituency all your life, you've been to school there, you've brought up your own children and sent them to school there, you've used the local hospitals, you've made an impact in the community. Oh, no, you can't stand for the seat because it's reserved for a woman. That, to my mind, is a complete nonsense, and it's what guarantees low quality. And the first time that we had women as a result of positive discrimination was Tony Blair's first parliament. We could all tell who they were. We used to sit there on our side shouting out positive discrimination because they simply just didn't perform like the others performed. And I vividly remember about 6 months after they all came, 101 of them, you might as well have had 101 Dalmatians, quite honestly. So 101 of these new female MPs coming on the Labour side. And one of them came up to me in a corridor in the Commons and she said, "Anne, isn't it horrible how the men are so rude to us?" And I said, "Yes. And isn't it horrible how they're so rude to each other?" And she hadn't thought of that. She'd just been roughed up in the chamber. She thought it was because she was a woman. In fact, it was because she was useless.
You know, so people watching this now, we've just heard you say that you've seen it yourself, that that happens.
I have
people
seen
are chosen.
Yep.
So what have you seen that for you makes you think that is happening categorically?
Oh, categorically. It's in the party rules. And I was at a selection meeting when the selection committee wanted to put four people on the shortlist, three men, one woman. They were told they couldn't do that. They had to have two men, two women. And we said, well, hang on, you know, the next woman down is a long way back. There are men in between. No, no. So I said, are you telling us, and I actually said this to the central office agent, Tory central office agent. I said, are you telling us we can't select on merit? And he was very honest. He said, yes. And I said, okay, supposing we do. He said, I'll invalidate the selection.
Wow.
So I've seen it. I've seen it at first hand.
Let's take the views now of Anne Widdecombe, who is a former Home Office minister, broadcaster and best-selling author. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning, Mark.
Anne, did you anticipate that Nigel Farage would provoke a by-election when he announced that he'd be speaking about his future on X yesterday?
No, I certainly didn't anticipate it, but I have to say, I think it's the right course to take. Now, this is a very decisive man. I mean, this is the man who, for years and years and years, you know, we heard from successive governments, so you can't do anything about ECHR, we've just got to obey their judgments. And Nigel said, well, no, actually, we don't. Now, that is the sort of decision-taking that is needed in the leader of the country. And he has now taken a very similar attitude in this personal circumstance. And he has said, you know, I don't have to put up with all this hounding and harassment for as long as, you know, the establishment or the press fancy it. I can actually take matters into my own hands now. And that is what he's done. And I think that's what makes Nigel Farage so different.
But Anne, you believe in probity in public life. Is it not right that the parliamentary authorities want to investigate the nature of this £5 million gift, even if Mr. Farage is vindicated?
Oh, I don't have a problem with the committee investigating anything it wants to investigate. But let's remember what happened with Boris Johnson. Boris's defence was that he didn't knowingly mislead the House. Yes, he said something that wasn't right, but he didn't know. And the committee actually, I mean, for the first time, changed the terms and said, well, actually, it wasn't necessary to prove that you didn't know. You know, you merely had to mislead Parliament. You didn't have to do it knowingly. Well, that was a complete change. You know, I've got very little trust left now in parliamentary processes. And if you look at this government, which has a majority on that committee, if you look at this government, you know, look at the way that it's reacted when it's felt vulnerable. you know, changes to political donations, cancelling local elections, we all remember that, you know, going for votes at 16, loosening the voter ID requirements, you know, you just name it. I mean, they react in such a way that is geared all around self-preservation. Now, Nigel is challenging that establishment, and he's called this the establishment versus the people, and I think that just about sums it up. And I'm delighted that he's taken this, because the attitude previously of politicians was that you just had to endure it. You gritted your teeth, and, you know, if you were being subject to fame after fame after fame and it wouldn't go away, you just carried on until your position became untenable. He's taking, and I drew the analogy with policy decisions earlier, he has taken this decision because he wants an end one way or the other. And he's right to do this. You know, they're going to lack credibility if there's a by-election and a huge majority for Nigel. There's going to be a great lack of credibility if he's still hounded and pursued.
Does this establishment of which you and Nigel speak actually exist?
Yes, I believe it does. Now, I didn't always believe in that theory, but I do think now that different parts of the establishment act in ways which I think are extremely questionable. We saw it only in the banking scandal. You know, and suddenly realised it wasn't just Nigel. A load of other people as well who didn't have the ability to publicise and fight it. So, yes, I think the establishment is there in that sense, yes.
However, Anne, it's not clear what we will achieve from this by-election, particularly given that the other parties are not standing. So therefore, if it's just Farage versus Count Binface, this is not serious politics, is it? It's student politics, and it's a pantomime.
No, it's very serious politics. So it's up to the other parties whether they stand or not. We know why they're not. They're frit. They know darn well they can't beat Nigel. They don't want to spend the resources campaigning and all the rest of it when they know they can't beat him. They're frit.
Farage versus Binface is not serious politics, Anne.
Can I finish? They're for it, so that's why they're not standing. No, it's their decision not to stand, not Nigel's. Their decisions. And this is serious politics. In this sense, Binface isn't serious politics, forget it. But what Nigel will spend that campaigning period doing is what he told us he would do. He will clear his name and he will ask the peaceful people of Clacton to express a vote of confidence in him. That is not pantomime. That is taking the initiative, thank heaven.
But Anne, why doesn't he clear his name with the parliamentary authorities rather than the people of Clacton who are going to vote for him?
And they've already
said... It's an empty gesture, isn't it?
And the parliamentary authorities...
Meaningless.
Can I finish?
Please do.
And the parliamentary authorities have already said... Now, they're not going to report till September. I mean, there is no urgency there. And Nigel is saying, right, you know, I'm not going through this until September. I'm not just going to let this go on. I'm going to challenge it. I'm going to face it down. That is the essence of Nigel.
But Anne, how does a certain number of people in Clacton re-electing Nigel clear his name? How does that clear him? I don't understand.
Well, sorry, you don't understand.
I mean, it will tell us he's popular, but that's not the same as being cleared.
Yes, it is, if he puts the facts before the people of Clacton, and the people of Clacton decide in exactly the same way that you put facts to a jury. If he is putting facts to the people of Clacton, and the people of Clacton accept those facts and turn in with a thumping great majority, that is the people speaking.
I agree, Anne. If the other parties run... But in the absence of Labour, the Lib Dems and the Conservatives, this victory will not be legitimate and it will clear nothing.
Of course it's legitimate. I mean, we had exactly the same in Holton Price and Houghton, and I thought it was bad news at the time, but David Davis stood, and the other parties took one look. I mean, this was a solid Tory seat. They weren't going to win. They didn't stand. What actually matters now is the people of Clacton saying... we believe in Nigel, and that, I think, will add enormous strength.
But Anne, it would mean that reform voters have voted reform. That's not a story, is it?
Well, it depends, first of all. I mean, if, for example, his well, his majority will obviously increase because there are no other candidates. But if his vote increases, you know, if there's a very solid, I mean, the press will be there every day, in fact. You know, and if Nigel's side of this can be properly reported, maybe it's an advantage. Maybe it's an advantage that there won't be the opposition. I don't know. But what I do know is this is a decisive action from a decisive man, and I yearn for him to leave the country because he'll take exactly that same level of decisiveness to the task.
Well, Anne, you're decisive and you've been incredibly ideologically consistent for so many years, which is why you felt you needed to leave the Conservative Party, firstly to get Brexit done, and also because on a different media network you told me on air that the Tories are institutionally woke. You've been proven right. Can I ask you about the wider project and the Reform UK issue? Do you think, Anne, that if Nigel had his time again, he would have declared the 5 million, notwithstanding that it was a gift?
Only he can answer that, Mark. Only he can answer these questions about his financial...
Would it have been probably the better thing to do, even if it was a gift, just to be up front? Because he's a very straight talker, isn't he, just like you?
I'm not going to say that, because I do not know the details. Now, there's a massive commentary going on at the moment from people who simply don't know the details. And
if it was your 5 million, Anne, would you have declared it? If it was a gift from a friend, and my God, if I had 5 million, I'd give it to you because you are one in a million and you would be worth every penny. You'd be forced to have afternoon tea with me every day, but that's fine. Everyone has a price to pay. But if someone had bunged you 5 mil, you would have declared it, Anne.
Oh, I ideally wish I had friends who could bung me 5 mil. I absolutely love it. I might or might not, depending on the circumstances. Now, and that is the crunch test here. You know, were the circumstances such that it should have been declared or that it shouldn't? Now, yes, you're quite right. I always erred on the side of caution.
Right.
I declared the last bunch of flowers because that way there could never be any question. But Nigel is actually, and I think this is worth looking at, Nigel is interpreting the rules in the way that they were originally envisaged, which is there anything which might reasonably influence the way you vote and the decisions you take in Parliament. That was the original intention of the Register. It wasn't for me to have to declare that I had been interviewed by Basil Brush because it might influence my vote on hunting. You know, I mean, absolute rot. I mean, you know, there was a serious purpose to it. Now it's just a game.
Well, Anne, I do tend to agree with you because ultimately, as Parliament look at this, the authorities look at this £5 million donation, they cannot, can they, Anne, beyond reasonable doubt, prove that this was not a gift, because they would have to be mind readers and see inside the mind of Nigel Farage. Ultimately, it's their word against his. So if they rule against him, that will be inference. Well, that's not very solid, is it? That was something that did for Prince Harry in the High Court yesterday.
Yes, and I'm delighted that it did do for Prince Harry in the High Court yesterday. But that's a side issue.
Inference is not evidence.
Quite right. Brilliant. Quite right. I'm not going to argue with that.
And Anne, what about the link between this generous donation and Mr. Farage's enthusiasm for cryptocurrency? Could the two things be connected?
I doubt it very much, but it's a bit like Christopher Harborne saying, for example, that he gave the gift to Nigel because he was so delighted with the work he'd done on Brexit. But that doesn't mean that he gave the gift to Nigel in order that he could achieve Brexit. He was already trying his hardest and spent 20 years trying to do that. It was merely saying, oh, you know, I do like what doing and I want to reward you. But the reason that I said at the beginning, you've just said, you know, you have to be mind readers to know what's going on. Mm. The reason I said at the beginning is that I can't answer questions about Nigel's finances. Only he can, and in this by-election, he will.
And Anne, before we let you go, how do you see all of this playing out? Do you think that Nigel will have the last laugh? Because I'm wondering, for example, whether it would be very embarrassing for the parliamentary authorities if they provoke yet another by-election after this one. Has Nigel set an extraordinary bear trap for them?
I certainly think that, you know, they will have to hesitate about, you know, a third election. I mean, they've had a general election. Now they're getting a by-election. Inflicting another by-election won't go down well, not only in Clacton, it won't go down well anywhere. And I think most people will say enough is enough. But we'll have to see. I can't. I'm not a mind reader. I can't say what the committee will do.
Anne, always a joy and a deep privilege to have you on the show. We are your number one fan. We look forward to catching up soon. My thanks to the redoubtable Anne Widdecombe, former Home Office Minister, broadcaster, best-selling author and politics legend. We love having Anne on. She's very forthright. She doesn't take any nonsense, does she? One of the best prime ministers we never had. Let's listen to Farage, who insists that he's done nothing wrong.
Let me be absolutely clear. After the furore and the media pile-on, well, not just the media, the other political parties too. Let me be absolutely clear. I have done nothing wrong. I have not broken the law in any way at all. I have not misused public money. And, you know, for the first 2 years of being an MP, my personal MP expenses are zero.
Zia Yousaf, the Shadow Home Secretary for Reform UK, is live on Talk Breakfast in just 40 minutes' time at 9 a.m. A by-election. Will Nigel have the last laugh? Who better to ask than Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson, Zia Yousaf. Good morning, Zia.
Good morning.
Well, many of us didn't see that coming. What is the thinking behind this move?
Well, look, we've had a ongoing witch hunt now for weeks against Nigel Farage, an extraordinary witch hunt, actually, given the total lack of scrutiny for Mr. Andy Burnham, who, last I checked, is literally going to become the Prime Minister of this country in a few days' time without any mandate at all. But here's the most important point, that, as we know, parliamentary standards is investigating as a result of complaints that have been made, and they're going to continue that investigation. But the most severe sanction that that committee can impose on Nigel if they find against him, which we believe they will, because Nigel's done nothing wrong. But the most severe sanction would, of course, be something that leads to a parliamentary by-election. What Nigel has done is say, look, what he's instead of letting Labour and the Tories try and fight him through their friends in the media, who appear in some cases to be willing to break the law, let's go to the ultimate authority, the highest possible authority, and ask them what they think of Nigel's performance and probity as a member of Parliament for Clacton-on-Sea. And of course, that is the great people of Clacton. And that's why he has called this by-election, which is absolutely the people versus the establishment.
Well, I think it was a political masterstroke, Zia, until Labour, the Lib Dems and the Tories decided not to field a candidate. It's now going to be Nigel versus Count Binface. Surely that wasn't the plan.
Well, we had to assume that there was a chance that this would happen. I mean, remember, what Nigel has done is actually show extraordinary courage in calling this election. And that's obviously in stark contrast to most of the political establishment. All they do is try and mitigate risk. But what I would encourage your listeners and viewers to do is ask yourself why. Why would Labour and the Tories especially choose to not stand candidates against a man who has been a thorn in their side, brought down umpteen of their prime ministers through his political campaigning in his career over the last few decades? Why? It's only one reason, and that is because they know that they would lose. And so therefore, they want to go and continue. They want to try and continue to litigate this through their friends in the media. And in the end, it's going to be up to the people of Clacton-on-Sea, the great people of Clacton, to make a determination on Nigel's performance.
There will be no Labour, Tory, Restore or Lib Dem candidates or Greens, Zia. Now, as a proud patriot that you are, you'll be well aware that England are playing Norway on Saturday night. And if Norway were not on the pitch, you couldn't call that a victory. Well, that's what's going to happen in Clacton-on-Sea.
Well, no, the analogy doesn't quite work, because what Labour, the Tories and all these other parties have done is have effectively, you know, knock over their king before the game even begins. What they've said is that we stand no chance of winning. They've shown immense disrespect to the electorate. And listen to some of the statements that we've heard from, for example, Kemi Badenoch, who said that she would not stand a Tory candidate in this, quote, fake by-election, would stand in, quote, the next one, which was an extraordinary statement. It would appear that Kemi Badenoch has an insight into what parliamentary standards are going to determine. It's unsurprising, because that's how the establishment operates. You've heard Ed Davey say, with a sneering tone, that Nigel Farage is trying to get his get the voters in Clacton, the people of Clacton, to help him out. And the tone with which he said people of Clacton was as if they were some sort of nefarious body. Well, no, Mr. Davey, actually, they are the most important people with regards to determining Nigel Farage's fate. They are the ones that matter. It is the voters. And we shouldn't forget, and I don't think your listeners would have forgotten, it was the Tories and Labour who coordinated together, of course, to cancel elections for millions of people in England in 2025, tried it again this year, but thankfully, because Nigel and Reform did a judicial review, we managed to prevent them from doing that, and they lost thousands of councillors between them, the Tories and Labour. So they hate democracy. The last thing they want is to give actual voters a say. We know that. There's plenty of evidence for that. And what Nigel is the opposite. Let's go to the highest possible authority and let the people of Clacton cast their vote. And, you know, the legitimacy of an election is not determined by Kemi Badenoch or Keir Starmer or Andy Burnham or Ed Davey and their decision about whether to stand a candidate or not. The legitimacy of a British election is intrinsic. We're going to fight that election. And I'm confident that the great people of Clacton will return Nigel Farage as an MP in the House of Commons.
Now, Zia, you are one of the country's highest profile politicians. You have designs on becoming the Home Secretary of this country. The polls would suggest you're heading in that direction. You're also an incredibly accomplished and successful businessman. And I think one of the more attractive aspects of the Reform offer is to make the United Kingdom a business-friendly environment and to be very supportive of wealth creators who, you know as well as I do, pay so many of the taxes in this country. There's nothing entrepreneurial about being given £5 million by a rich person, is there?
No, but Nigel never claimed that that was entrepreneurship. But what it was a payment which allowed Nigel to be safe. And look, I take this quite personally. Perhaps I shouldn't, because it's not really the done thing in politics. They advise you against it. But, you know, I've worked with Nigel every single day for the last couple of years. I've seen firsthand the sacrifices that he makes. I was chairman of the party for the majority of the last couple of years, and I'm privy to his private security briefings, about which the public know precious, they only know a tiny fragment of the threats Nigel faces. And the fact that through decades of his political career, he has asked Home Secretary after Home Secretary for state protection, and they said no. They said no. And then when they finally did give him some security, they then cut it. Do you remember this? By 75%. And then Keir Starmer sent cabinet minister after cabinet minister to call Nigel, to equate Nigel to a Nazi. And frankly, to try to create, I called it stochastic terrorism. I think it was disgusting. It made me lose all respect for Keir Starmer. The idea he's a decent man is nonsense. And so, the fact that a patriotic British citizen has been extraordinarily successful in business, saw fit to give Nigel an unconditional gift to be spent on security so that Nigel could be safe. I, for one, take my hat off to him. And I think there are millions of people around the country who do the same. And I want to make this point, too, because I've said this publicly. If we get a Reform government and I'm the Home Secretary, and you can play these words back to me.
Yeah.
No matter how much I disagree with other MPs and their political views, it is unacceptable for anyone to be who is in public life as an MP to be worried about their safety. And I won't hesitate to deploy state resources to protect our MPs with whatever resources they need. No MP will ever come to me if I'm Home Secretary and ask for protection in the face of credible threats and be told no.
And Mr. Youssef, it will be Farage versus Binface in Clacton-on-Sea. How does Reform UK voters voting Reform clear Mr. Farage's name?
Well, in the end, they're the only people that matter. And the bigger Nigel's majority in Clacton-on-Sea, the bigger the message is to the establishment. Again, look, Mark, when was the last time you see, we keep hearing that politics is broken and the parties can't work together. And look at the level of coordination from the establishment. Within a few hours, you had the Labour Party, the Conservative Party, the Liberal Democrats, the Green Party, all announced that they're not going to stand candidates, call the election fake, all of this stuff. Say that they're going to stand in the next one, which is absolutely prejudging the investigation. And maybe there's a clue there as to what's really going on here, given it is actually a panel of MPs that determine any potential sanction. So I've said this earlier today, if HS2 was run with this level of coordination and efficiency by the political establishment, we would have trains twice the speed of sound for about £10. It's absolutely extraordinary. So when the establishment wants to mobilize, boy, can it mobilize. But unfortunately, it mobilizes to protect itself. In this case, to try to do in and to intimidate out of public life, Nigel Farage is simply not going to work. And that's why we have this people versus the establishment by-election.
Are you concerned, Zia, that there are figures within Reform UK who are leaking sensitive information about the party and about the boss?
No, look, I think...
Is that just politics?
I don't have concerns about that. I mean, listen, you know, I would point you to the fact that I saw the political correspondent for GB News posted just minutes before Nigel's statement yesterday that, you know, senior figures in Reform, he couldn't get anything out of them as to what Nigel was going to announce. People heard it for the first time, and that's how we operate. But obviously, as you get bigger as a party, sadly, there are some people who might do that sort of thing. I don't know.
So you don't deny that there may be figures within the Reform fold who are leaking negative things to the press?
I don't think that there are, but I wanted to make the point here that we will answer to anything that people throw at us. I mean, my God, think about what people have already thrown at Nigel and thrown at Reform over the next couple of years. Dominic Cummings explicitly said, if you remember, that he believes that there's unelected institutions in Britain will absolutely break the law, do illegal things in order to keep Nigel Farage out. We've got certainly on its face a case for that already. You may have seen this Guardian story that the NCA has leaked private and confidential information, which on its face does appear to be a criminal offence, and we're going to be pursuing that. You better believe that. So look, I think that's all part of politics. I would say the people around Nigel, we are extremely loyal. And again, the acid test for that is nobody, not even the most well-connected senior political pundits and journalists knew what Nigel was going to announce until he said it.
And do you think the party have exaggerated the actions and motivations of Sky News with suggestions that somehow Nigel Farage's kid, to paraphrase Robert Jenrick on Sky News, was harassed by the news organisation?
Not at all. I think it's disgraceful the way that they have behaved. I mean, let's just look at the facts. Right. I don't need to editorialize this. Let's look at the facts. What happened is a journalist for Sky News turned up at the home of Nigel Farage's daughter. And again, I wouldn't wish this on anybody. You know, as much as I despise the politics of Ed Davey or Chris, I would never, ever, ever say that it is appropriate for a journalist to turn up at the home of somebody's child, particularly given the efforts Nigel has made to not put them to keep them away from politics, which he does. And then to compound matters, instead of apologizing for that, they then came out. You may remember those reports were, well, you know, Sky News denies contacting Nigel's daughter. Well, then we published the receipts and we showed that it did happen. Now they're claiming that, oh, well, we were just trying to find Nigel, as if nobody at Sky News has Nigel Farage's telephone number. It's an absolute disgrace. And you can watch that footage for yourself. I think it's a coordinated attempt to try to intimidate Nigel. And look, I want to reiterate this. It's very difficult being in public life. There's a reason why many people, great, talented people, don't want to do it, which is a shame. And that's why I'm saying it is. I would be saying exactly the same thing if this was the leader of any other party or another MP. I want to make sure MPs feel safe and have the level of protection that they need so they can articulate their political arguments effectively and without fear, whether or not I agree with them. And secondly, that there must be some standards in the media. Yes, you can absolutely. Here's the other evidence, by the way, that, you know, Sky claiming that they thought they were just trying to find Nigel. The evidence that they knew Nigel wasn't there is that they sent somebody to go and confront Nigel when he was getting off the plane. They actually knew precisely where Nigel was. And I take great exception to that. The turning up at Nigel's daughter's home. And there's no public interest in that whatsoever. I should also point out this comes within days, of course, of a broadsheet newspaper publishing a picture of Nigel Farage's daughter's home. You think those three things are not connected? I think it's a disgrace. And again, whether or not you agree with Nigel, agree with me or Reform, I just think if we cannot operate like this as a country. There are some things that are off limits, and I think Sky's behaviour is appalling. I think they should apologise.
And I spent half a day with the boss, Nigel Farage, your boss, just 2 weeks ago in an exclusive interview for the Daily Express. He looked happy, relaxed, comfortable in his own skin. But we've had these rumours swirling around, Zia, that Nigel is ill, that he's got health issues, that he's exhausted, and that actually he doesn't even want the top job.
Well, I consider myself quite a high-energy person, and Nigel consistently makes me feel low-energy when I speak to him at 6:30 in the morning, and he's got he's like a Duracell bunny. So if that's the case, then God help the rest of us. I would not take too seriously some of those things you read in the hostile media.
And can I ask you about Sky News? Will the party consider a boycott for future interviews as a result of this?
I mean, maybe. I mean, look, I think it is important that you have a healthy media ecosystem in this country. And again, this is about upholding standards in public life, of which the media have an important role to play. It's totally fair to scrutinize public figures like Nigel or myself, but it is totally unfair and unreasonable, and I think deeply unethical, to turn up at the daughter of at Nigel's daughter's home, and then B, to lie about it. I think those things are terrible, and I think they've backed themselves into a corner here. So let's see how they respond.
And we know, as we discuss every day here on Talk, Zia, that the country faces so many problems. We're paying a very high price for net zero policies. In fact, the highest energy cost in the developed world. It's the effective deindustrialization of the country. And it's terrible news for the economy. And then we've also got the open borders, and we have the cult of welfareism. Are you concerned now that this is all about Nigel and turning into something of a pantomime?
No, so it's the opposite. So this is precisely why, one of the key reasons why Nigel has done this, because there was an article yesterday in the Times saying the earliest standards were going to come to any determination would be September. So this would have kept this as a, you know, as the main story for months and months. And we can ill afford that. You know, British people are struggling in a cost of living crisis. We still don't have a functioning border. We've got well north of a million illegal migrants in this country. That number's growing all of the time. Our national security is a joke. Our defense and our armed forces have been hollowed out. And regardless, again, of your political persuasion, the majority of British people, poll after poll, shows that they see Nigel Farage and Reform as the real opposition holding this awful Labour government to account. And given we're going to have a new prime minister who only 0.03% of the country voted for taking office in just a few days, we're going to need Reform. We're going to need Nigel, clear-headed, focused on holding this awful Labour government to account. And I want to reiterate, we need a general election.
Fantastic to have you on the show. Zia Yusuf, thank you for your valuable time. Reform UK's Home Affairs spokesperson, very much four square behind his boss in effectively provoking a by-election at Clacton-on-Sea. Your reaction to what you've heard from Zia Yusuf, 03444991000. Will Nigel have the last laugh? 9:19, this is Talk Breakfast.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Assistant Chief Constable Matt Longman here at Devon and Cornwall Police, and I'd like to read you this short statement now on our whereabouts today. We can confirm that a 26-year-old man was arrested at an address in Newton Abbot this afternoon on suspicion of the murder of Anne Widdecombe. The suspect, who is a white British national, remains in police custody whilst inquiries continue. Officers were called to Miss Widdecombe's home at Haytor by the ambulance service around 11:40 a.m. on Thursday the 9th of July. Sadly, 78-year-old Miss Widdecombe was located deceased within the property. She has sustained serious injuries. Her next of kin have been informed and are being supported by specially trained officers. Detectives from the Force Major Crime Investigation Team have launched a murder investigation and are conducting extensive inquiries into the circumstances surrounding Miss Widdecombe's death. While we work closely with our partners and have consulted counter-terrorism policing as part of our initial inquiries, the incident is not being treated as terrorism. A cordon remains in place at the property while specialist officers continue forensic examinations. There are road closures in place around the scene, and the public will see significant police activity in the area while detectives and other officers continue house to house and CCTV inquiries. This is an extremely tragic incident. Our thoughts are very much with the family and friends of Miss Widdicombe at this very difficult time. Our murder inquiry is in its early stages but moving at significant pace, and we are deploying all the necessary resources to find out exactly what has happened. I would appeal to anyone who may have information about this incident, however insignificant it may seem, to come forward and speak with us. While we release further information when we're able to do so, but in the meantime, I would ask people not to speculate about what might have happened, particularly on social media. That's not only potentially harmful to our investigation, but also deeply distressing to the family and friends of Miss Widdicombe. We've set up a major incident public portal for information. Images or footage can be submitted to us there, and this can be found easily on our website. Information can also be passed anonymously to the independent charity Crime Stoppers. Thank you very much. I'll now take a few short questions.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're here on Hator, up high on an absolutely magnificent, beautiful day. Anne's house, just down the road from us, a place where I was a welcome visitor more than once. And she really loved this place. She loved the moor in all its moods. She loved its wildlife. She enjoyed the panoramic views from her bungalow, right across, looking out over the English Channel. And while she was part of the community here and very well known, she also had that solitude and peace in her home, in her garden, that meant so very, very much to her. She really did love this place. And it seems extraordinary on a beautiful day like this to think of the not only untimely, but violent, barbaric manner of her death. She was a remarkable individual. Redoubtable, I think the word was invented for her. Opponents knew exactly what to expect from her, and at times, I have to say, colleagues did feel the wrath of her tongue. She was the fiercest proponent of free speech I think I've ever met. She believed that we had the freedom and the right to say things that insulted each other. Her career in politics, of course, spanned decades as a minister, and then for many years as a shadow minister. And I spoke to one of her colleagues last night who said during those years in a shadow cabinet, she was the only one who always, always, always spoke up for what she believed to be the national interest. Her patriotism was deep within her, deep within her family. She was immensely proud of the work her father had done with the Royal Navy during the war. But she was so much more than just a politician. After 2010, suddenly Anne Widdicombe, the socially conservative Christian politician, suddenly appears on Strictly Come Dancing, on Big Brother, doing theatre tours all around the country, one-woman evening shows with Anne Widdicombe, writing novels. Quite remarkable what she did. And then suddenly in 2019, as it appeared that the Brexit vote wasn't actually going to be carried out by the government or parliament, I took a phone call one day. Anne Widdicombe here. I sort of stood to attention. I mean, you would. Announcing that she'd love to run for us in the European elections. Her joining what was a completely brand new party directly contributed to us winning by a country mile 6 weeks later, the removal of Theresa May, Boris Johnson becoming Prime Minister, and Brexit happening. She played a very major role in getting Brexit over the line. Although, having said that, she was pretty unhappy with the Brexit deal. It wasn't the one that she actually wanted. As a colleague, she was phenomenal. Her work rate was unbelievable. She'd turn up anywhere in the country to speak. And of course, unlike modern politicians, Anne didn't need notes. She stood bestride the stage, knowing exactly what she had to say. Her convictions were fierce. She never sought popularity for the sake of it. She just stood up and fought for what she believed in. She was a great colleague, loved by all of us that worked with her, even if, as I say at times, she would tell me I was wrong in terms of what I was doing, in no uncertain terms. And I've come here today to lay this wreath and to start this memorial, not just on my own behalf, not just on behalf of the Reform Party, but on behalf of many, many millions around this country that admired her, loved her, thought she was a remarkable human being who made a massive contribution to public life in Britain over very, very many decades. May the God that she believed in bless her soul.
Mr. Farage.
Thank you.
And I now look to Anne Widdecombe, ex-secretary, ex-treasurer, to close the case for the opposition tonight.
Hello, Oxford Union. Here I am, right back where I started from 50 years ago. And do you know what the subject of my first paper speech was? It was censorship. Plus ça change, as Juncker might say. Now, tonight is crucial. This is not just any old Thursday debate at the Oxford Union. There was a moment in the past when what happened here had reverberations round the world. And that was when this House decided that it would not fight for king and country. And it gave immense comfort to a rather nasty regime. And tonight it is crucial that this House, this bastion of freedom, this renowned historical organisation that has always been devoted to free speech, does not tonight go the other way and make a decision in favour of censorship. What we are debating here tonight is crucial. Now, I speak with feeling. When I was growing up, it was in the immediate post-war period when people had lost sons, husbands, fathers to the Nazis. They'd lost limbs and faced a life of disability. They had lost homes. They had lost them to a vile regime called National Socialism. And yet, Oswald Mosley and Colin Jordan and other such charming souls were allowed in law to hold their rallies in this country. You think how much offence, how much hurt, how much insult that caused to people who had made such major sacrifices. But the devotion to free speech and the recognition that we had spent 6 years fighting for liberty led us to believe that it was preferable to have free speech than not to be offended. And then a few years later, when I was here, we were right at the height of the Cold War. And it's difficult to remember 30 years after the Berlin Wall came down. But we were actually at a stage when all along the borders of what were then the Warsaw Pact countries, the Soviet Union had stationed weapons pointing straight at us. And yet, you could still stand for Parliament as a communist. You probably wouldn't get in, but you could still stand. You could stand on street corners and sell the Morning Star. You could subscribe openly to the Communist Party. And I expect that gave a lot of offence, and that caused a lot of hurt, and probably also alarm. But we believed that free speech was more important. Now, only two sorts of people oppose free speech, and they are at opposite ends of the scale. Snowflakes and totalitarians. Now, Celeste. Celeste says there's nothing wrong with being a snowflake. No, you can be as snowflakish as you like, providing you don't try to impose that on other people. I am offended, upset, insulted at least 30 times a day. Tough. Celeste upset me. Celeste wounded me. Celeste has caused me trauma. She poured scorn on my Paso Doble. And does she realise that in 15 years' time, I am still going to be traumatised and I am going to form a movement? Me Too dancers who were insulted in the Oxford Union. Oh, come on. Nobody has the right to live their lives being protected from offence or from insult or from hurt feelings. It is an occupational hazard of living in society. And if you really can't take it, become a hermit. But more seriously, on the opposite end from the snowflakes, poor little darlings, on the opposite end from them are the totalitarians. And that was how Hitler was so successful, because he did not allow any free speech whatever. And if you spoke out against that sickening regime, or indeed against the Soviet Union, 2 minutes more, no, I need at least five, or spoke out in the Soviet Union, you would end up in prison, if not worse. Totalitarians like to curtail your right to disagree with state orthodoxy. Now, for state orthodoxy, substitute the words social orthodoxy. As exemplified by social media, Twitter, and other such places, where people decide what is and what is not acceptable. Now, I would love to stand in this union and oppose and argue with and take to pieces a Holocaust denier. But if we say no, we can never have the Holocaust denier because his views are so offensive that he cannot be accorded a platform, then what happens? That sort of viewpoint is driven underground where it can quite often flourish. And people whisper behind their hands, oh, you know, there's something in what he says, but we're not allowed to hear it. Let's hear it. And by hearing it, we can destroy it. We should also remember... We should also remember that today's heresy can become tomorrow's credo. How fortunate we were that the Wilberforces of this world, the Pankhursts, the Martin Luther Kings, and everybody else who has over time and with massive effort changed society, how grateful we may be that they were not no platforms because it offended the society of their time. Now, I recently was asked If I objected to sharing a platform with somebody who had spoken in favour of, had not been involved in, but had spoken in favour of the IRA. Now, I lost a friend in the Brighton bomb. I missed the Brighton bomb by less than 20 minutes. And I looked at this person and I said, "So you wanted to blow me up?" And she said, "Well, I didn't want to do it myself." I do not object to sharing a platform and arguing with her, because by arguing with her, I can expose what is wrong. It is absolutely right that we should allow people, no matter how profoundly we disagree with them — I hate to utter clichés in this august debating hall, but I am going to utter one — that no matter how much we may disagree with somebody, we should defend to the hilt their right to say it. And that is something that I have believed all my life, that you succeed by defeating your opponent, not by wishing him away. You get nowhere by trying not to hear what is being said, not to hear the other arguments. As I said at the beginning, and I do passionately appeal to you tonight, this is not about which side wins. This is about whether the Oxford Union, of all bodies, will vote in favour of the diminution of free speech. Whether we will agree, and I say we because I'm a life member of this place, whether we will agree that somebody else may decide what we can and can't hear. And just remember this: you may feel virtuous today in what you will not hear, but tomorrow somebody may feel virtuous in not hearing what you have to say. Free speech is for all, not for the privileged few.